Thanks for tuning in to kpcradio.com. Today is Monday, April 24th. I'm your host, Skylar Lester, and you're listening to Exposure, where we shine light on notable figures in the world of photography. Today's guest is Marissa Roth, a longtime photojournalist, documentary photographer, and curator based in Los Angeles. Marissa has traveled extensively for her project, One Person Crying, Women in War, where she specifically focuses on documenting the effect that conflict has on women around the world. Her work has been seen in numerous museum exhibitions worldwide and has been published in the New York Times. In addition, she was part of the LA Times photography staff that won a Pulitzer Prize for Best Spot News for its coverage of the 1992 Los Angeles riots. Hello, Marissa. Welcome to the show, and thanks so much for coming on.
Hi, Skylar. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So to give our listeners a little bit of a kind of background on you, how is it that you got into photography?
Well, I would say how I got into photojournalism was probably a natural path. I was always creative as a kid and painting, drawing, and then I discovered my mother's Instamatic camera, which I appropriated at the age of 11. And so I was always taking pictures of friends and family. And then in high school, I took a photo class and learned darkroom, which was wonderful. And then in college, I was a staff photographer on the UCLA Daily Bruin. And that's really when I sort of got bitten by the photojournalism bug. And I had always been influenced by photojournalism coming of age in the 60s and 70s, and predominantly the Vietnam War. So it was really that imagery that, while I didn't fully understand what it was in the sense of what it meant, but I was completely affected by it. And I think became an activist without even realizing what the definition of that was. So,
Interesting. Yeah. And you mentioned, painting and drawing. Do you still ever draw and paint, or is it mostly photography as your art form?
Oh, well, I think it's interesting. My last two projects, probably starting with the Tibet project, and then I'm sort of in the midst of doing a project on the Atlantic Ocean. They feel definitely like I'm coming back to painting in a way, but through photographs, which I guess is the true definition of photography, which is, painting with light. Mm-hmm. So the photos, even though they're straight photographs, feel more abstract. Mm-hmm. And these two projects are with color film, whereas the Women and War project was with, the whole thing was with black and white film.
Interesting.
So I suppose I'm coming back, but I keep buying paints and sumi brushes and keep hoping I'll be quiet enough to actually sit down and do it. But I think I'm a little scared to sort of resurrect that art form because it's been so long. So, yeah.
How has your knowledge of painting and art history influenced your work as far as your photography goes?
I love in Italian Renaissance painting, there's a term called chiaroscuro, which is sort of the interplay of darks and shadows, light, darks and lights, shadows. And that always, I loved that in painting, certainly like Caravaggio mm-hmm. employed that. And I guess I do love sort of visual drama, but even Gauguin, I love his painting, the Impressionist painter, his paintings to me feel almost like they have photographic compositions. Mm-hmm. And so I think they just influence me. And in terms of also the graphics, composition of paintings. It was deeply influenced. And also, sort of the continuity of sort of the visual arts and as a form of expression. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And your photos from the One Person Crying project, they're beautiful and very powerful. What was it that made you want to focus specifically on the impact that war has on women around the world?
I should sort of back up a bit or go sideways a bit, which is I didn't actually set out to do that project. Mm-hmm. It sort of started organically, just with subjects I was responding to as a photojournalist working in Asia and other parts of the world. I realized it was a subject that I was drawn to, and I kept sort of being drawn to it without fully understanding why. But the truth of the matter is my family, we have a deep Holocaust history, unfortunately, and my paternal grandparents were actually killed in a massacre in 1942 on the doorstep of their home. And so, but my parents were sort of tried to be forward thinking and not bear us down with the traumas and the pain. So the war was never talked about. The family members who got killed were never talked about. But something inside of me, I think, and I think because I was, you know, obviously this peace activist as a kid. So, but somehow I always felt, and as a woman, I was much more interested in the behind the scenes, to tell the story, what I felt was the underreported story of war. And I think because war is pretty much a male endeavor, and certainly photojournalism and photographers and then even painters who would paint war scenes before photography was invented, it was always from the male perspective, because if you're a man, that would be your perspective. And also it's you know, a battlefield is much more dramatic than, you know, sort of a village in the middle of nowhere. But I felt that this was an underreported aspect of war, and an under-considered one, because nobody thinks about who's keeping home and hearth together and who's keeping it all together. And so, yeah, it just happened. And then I guess it was in 99, after a trip to Albania, I was invited to go along on a medical mission during the bombing of Kosovo. And it was after that trip that I realized this was a recurring theme for me, and then decided to sort of designate it as a project that I'm sort of committing my heart and soul and finances and body and brain to, and then just really dove in and was much more proactive in terms of, you know, picking my subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And as a woman yourself, do you feel it's easier for you to connect and understand your female subjects?
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, there's a trust and a reciprocity. And as I was photographing these women, I started opening up and sharing my own family's history, which in a way gave me a past, in a sense, that I hadn't had before.
Mm-hmm.
Although it certainly brought up a lot of, you know, emotion. But yeah, I think as women, you know, you do connect, or you cry together, or you empathize. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So definitely, I think they trusted me, and yeah, so yeah.
It's special, the bond that you can create between subject and photographer when you have, you know, maybe common links through trauma or whatever it is. And it gives you, I guess, a sense of purpose too with the work.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, so many of the women had never talked about their war experience, whether it was, you know, German women who'd survived the siege of Berlin right after World War II, or some Cambodian women who survived, you know, the Pol Pot's regime and the genocide. Because I also interview my subjects. And so, I mean, this one German woman, I don't think anybody had asked her about what happened to her during the war for like 65 years. And she spoke literally for 6 hours. And I felt like, oh my God, this is almost like a kind of a therapy session for
mm-hmm.
her. And I couldn't shoot, you know, I mean, she was so sort of gone in her own emotions that I actually found it difficult to photograph her, because I just couldn't connect with her.
Hmm.
So I was just photographing. She kept bringing out artifacts like ration cards and childhood notebooks, and then little tiny photos of her and her mother, and then she kept bringing us cake and tea, and so I sort of nodded to my translator and I said, okay, just stop translating after 2 hours, and we just let her go, because I thought, you know, from a compassionate standpoint, I realized she just had to
mm-hmm.
express herself.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think as a photographer, you have kind of an obligation, you know, when it's this kind of work, because people are entrusting you with their soul and their heart and their stories and their pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I take that trust very seriously. I take that role, you know, very seriously.
Yeah, it's sensitive.
Yeah.
Does seeing the devastation that war can cause firsthand ever take its toll on you personally?
Yeah, I mean, this project, you know, I thought I was Miss Tuffy, and I'd worked as a photojournalist and covered all sorts of mayhem and natural disasters, from earthquakes, you know, fires. You know, I covered the riots here. I covered gang shootings quite a bit. I was in a coup attempt in the Philippines, and I thought, you know, I was just tough as nails, and I could withstand anything. And then the Women in War project progressed, and then in 2013, all of a sudden, I sort of had this episode where I just sort of fell apart and started having full-blown anxiety attacks. And I also, just as a sidebar, I did a project commissioned by the Museum of Tolerance here in LA to do a portrait series of 80 Holocaust survivors who were part of the museum, and ended up interviewing 70 Holocaust survivors. So the answer is yes, I got trauma-acquired PTSD, and realized I hadn't sort of downloaded all the painful stories and the traumatic stories that I'd heard. Mm-hmm. And it came back and bit me pretty hard. So fortunately, I have a good therapist who I've been working with, and I've just been working through it and finally debriefing and crying and healing body and soul. But it's still there, probably, but I just now avoid the triggers. But I feel I've gotten through, you know, a good part of it, but I still have to be careful because the trauma is, in a way, it's always there. And I suppose, in a way, absorbing the trauma of, you know, the details of the massacre that killed, you know, my grandparents and an uncle, great uncle, and my great grandmother. So, you know, that's already enough. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's a lot. But I mean, in addition to the difficulty and the weight of it, it also it seems like you're inspired to continue raising awareness through your work.
Completely.
And that's one really huge positive that comes out of all of it.
Yeah, and I'm very adamant that I call my women, I'm very possessive about them, but I call them survivors. I never refer to them as victims because they are sincerely, they've chosen life, you know, sort of in spite of everything. And you know, the human spirit can really be indomitable. And I'm not bitter or cynical, or I actually have still a lot of faith in humanity. I don't understand war at all. I still don't. I wish I did, but I'm still trying to work it out and figure it out. But at heart, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm still a peace activist. You know, I'm still that little kid, you know, sticking peace signs on everything, you know, around the house and on my mother's car and everywhere, you know. So yeah, I think, you know, the projects that I choose to do, certainly the project on Tibet, it's very painterly, and it's about, really about the monasteries and nunneries and the devotion, but it is also, I call it a cry for awareness, you know, about what is being lost. So yeah, so all of my work all has that sense of time is now, and we've got to address these subjects, and it's about, yeah, telling stories in order to get the message out and hopefully affect change.
Yeah, that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Tibet. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences there?
Tibet. It's my happiest place on earth, in spite of altitude sickness. I had always wanted to go there. I had done a number of stories in the 90s in India and in South Asia about the Tibetan diaspora, and was just drawn to Tibet and the Tibetans. And for my 50th birthday, decided that might be where I'd like to go to spend it. So I went and wasn't sure how I would react photographically, but I'd seen enough pictures of Tibet, and so I understood sort of the color palette that was there, the monasteries, the reds, the golden yellows, the sort of quiet earth tones, the vivid blue sky. And so I, rather than shoot black and white, I just couldn't imagine photographing in black and white. And so I chose to photograph with Kodachrome, when Kodachrome was still available. And I wasn't sure how I would respond or what I would respond to. And so I took, I think, 100 rolls on the first trip. And went, of course, my journalist brain said, okay, you have to have an idea and, you know, photograph the interface between the Han Chinese and Tibetan Chinese communities. And so I went with that idea, and that lasted about 2 hours on the afternoon of the first day. I was completely disinterested in it, actually, as a subject and visually. And then I just kind of let go. I also had bad altitude sickness, like everybody. So you're kind of like spaced out, which in a funny way was great because, you know, the chatter in our brains that's always there and the shoulds, you're too sick to have that. You're just kind of, your senses are almost desensitized and then hypersensitized. So I just started sort of seeing and feeling and enjoying, you know, being there, but also responding magically almost to, you know, kind of the energy of the place. And so, and then before I'd left, I'd had this almost like a vision, which I'm not prone to, but I did, which was to, I call it to unfurl the images by color, so by the colors of the Tibetan prayer flag. So I didn't obviously know what I would see, literal images, but I thought, okay, you know, maybe the blues and the yellow. So anyway, after the first trip, I was pretty pleased with the pictures and then started having my lab print up work prints. And then I was like, I thought, I have to go back. I have to go back immediately. And so couldn't, because first it was the Tibetan uprising in March 08, right after, about a year late, less than a year later. And then in 2009, I was so deep into the war project that I had no time, money, brain space. And then in, I think it was June of 2010, Kodak announced that if you had any rolls of Kodachrome, they had to be processed by December 31st of that year. And the one lab, I think, in the entire universe that they were supporting with Kodachrome chemistry. So I thought, oh, my God, okay, I have one of those moments. Do I go? Do I finish the project? Do I not go? Can I live with that? And I thought, no, I can't live with that. I have to go. I have to figure this out. So I called a friend of mine. I said, so, how about going to Tibet with me? And she's like, okay. So we ended up going that September. And so because I'd had the pictures from the first trip, there was one picture in a nunnery that was almost painterly and very impressionistic. And that was like a turning point for me, that photograph. And then the second trip, I even let myself go more almost abstract. But they're straight single images, and there's no manipulation, nothing. So the second trip definitely was amazing as well, and came back and so put the project together, and it's been a book now for about 2 years, and it just debuted as a traveling exhibition in March, actually down in Carlsbad at the William D. Cannon Art Gallery. And then it's going on to the Phoenix Art Museum this fall, so it's pretty exciting. And then I'll say something. I'm usually a little shy, but so the Dalai Lama wrote the foreword to the book. So
wow!
I'm pretty excited about that.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Did you get to meet him?
Not yet. I'm still trying to. So I have a feeling I'm going to have to go to Dharamsala to meet him. I have a feeling that I've tried here, I've tried in Orange County, and it just doesn't work. And so I'm thinking now, okay, maybe Dharamsala has to be part of my greater journey, so I'm peaceful with that. So I hope to get there maybe at the end of this year. Yeah,
it's just an excuse to go back to your happy place, right?
Well, no, I can't go back to Tibet,
no.
And I won't go back to Tibet. So no, Dharamsala is on the India side, and where the Tibetan government is in exile. No, I can't go back to Tibet because of the foreword to the book. But I don't think I want to go back. I want to keep sort of the memory of the two trips, you know, sort of sacred and pure.
As they were, yeah. Interesting. And so you were talking about the Kodachrome film. Do you shoot film exclusively?
No. I shoot digital for a lot of my work clients. But then I also did a personal project, which is actually at LAX now. It's part of the public art. It's called LAWA, Los Angeles World Airport, have a joint sort of art program for public art. And so I was curator photographer. And so that project is called Street Scene. And it's a project I did here in LA about being a pedestrian in LA. But that was shot with digital.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'll plug it. It's Terminal 6, Alaska Airlines, yeah, before security. So
neat.
You can have a little art before you, you know, fly to wherever.
Yeah, that's an interesting place to display work. It's definitely such a hustle and bustle environment that it can be really nice to have some artwork there to just, you know, you're waiting for your flight, yeah. You have a layover, and you can just really take it in. And
yeah, a lot of airports have it. And some places, like Vancouver Airport, it has beautiful installations in San Francisco. Yeah.
And really quick, the book that you had mentioned, what is the name of the book?
The Tibet book?
Yes.
It's Infinite Light, A Photographic Meditation on Tibet.
Cool. And where can people find that book?
They can find it on Amazon.com. I have three websites. My main website is MarissaRothPhotography.com. And then there's a site dedicated to the Women in War Project, which is called OnePersonCrying.com. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Tibet Project, which is TibetInfiniteLight.com.
Okay, great. And I definitely wanted to talk about your images of the riots. Your picture of the demolished gate with kind of framing the portrait of Martin Luther King in front of that burned building. It was the leading shot of the five-part series that was published in the Times that actually won your team the Pulitzer Prize. So how is it that you got that shot?
Completely, you know, I think life sometimes is pretty wild and magical. So in those days, I was also photographing for USA Today. Mm-hmm. And I had photographed a young musician named Tevin Campbell, and a local radio station purchased the image to make a billboard. And so the billboard was like coming down like 2 days later. And so I knew where it was in South Central. And so I was actually trying to find the billboard on the way, you know, as I was working after the riots, and happened to stumble on that scene with, mm-hmm. you know, this security gate that was, you know, burned out. Yeah. So it was just complete serendipity. I certainly wasn't looking for it, but I think as a photographer, certainly as a photojournalist, you know, because we have to rely on chance and then recognizing, putting all the pieces together very quickly. So it was just there.
Wow. And when you were photographing the riots, like, what was it that was going through your mind?
Well, I think the most profound moment that I had, which is still with me, is how thin the line is between civilization and anarchy, and how fast it can evaporate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that was sort of extraordinary, yeah. Heartbreaking, because everything you know is like shattered. It was scary. It was shocking. But not at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, LA is, it's actually pretty miraculous that we get along as well as we do, mm-hmm. Considering how many people are here, how many different, ethnicities, languages, everything. So,
yeah. In contrast to your work documenting people in kind of devastating situations or impoverished countries. You've also captured the glitz and glamour of the Hollywood scene here in Los Angeles. So how is it that you found yourself covering both extremes?
Well, you can't be a photojournalist in LA without covering Hollywood. I mm-hmm. mean, it's part of the beat. And it was pretty bizarre. I mean, I'd run to the paper and, you know, go photograph some dead gang member, you know, on the sidewalk covered with a white sheet, and then run back to the paper and then put on a, you know, fancy suit and then run to like the Beverly Hills Hotel and photograph Cary Grant or something. I mean, it was just
wow.
Like, it's like, God, this is quite bizarre. But yeah. I mean, it was sort of fun, although, you know, Hollywood is, we know, kind of a universe unto itself. Mm-hmm. But actually, in the end, I think it was a good counterbalance to all the heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I always tried to photograph Hollywood as a documentary photographer. So yeah, and show more of a realistic view or ironic or metaphorical view. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And do you have any upcoming exhibitions that would be in the Los Angeles area that our listeners could visit?
Oh, at the moment, not yet, I'm sorry to say. But the LAX show will be up until May 21st. And the Carlsbad show actually also till May 21st. So
wonderful. All right. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for today. But I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Exposure. It was a pleasure having you on.
Thanks, Skylar. I appreciate it. This was fun.
Yeah, definitely. And I want to remind our listeners that tonight is College Night at the Getty Museum. It's a free event for students that's going to take place from 6 to 9:30 p.m. Make sure to bring your student ID to gain access to music, activities, and an art exhibition that will include works made by Pierce College students. For KPCRadio.com, I'm your host, Skylar Lester. Have a fantastic week.